This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Love, Lucy by Lucille Ball. Performed by Lucy Arnaz.
Forward. One of my mother's favorite things to do when a small group of people were involved in some ordinary conversation was to wait until one of them left the room and as soon as she returned blurt out convincingly, "Here she is now, why don't you tell her to her face?" That was always followed by frozen silence, and then she'd howl with that depth-of-the-sea laugh she had to see the look on the poor soul's face who, for one horrible moment, thought that someone had been saying terrible things about her while she was gone. I'm not sure why, but I keep thinking about that now as I sit down to introduce you to this treasure. I lost my father at 5 minutes after midnight on December 2nd, 1986. And my mother at dawn, on April 26, 1989. For my brother Desi and me, it has been a difficult and complicated mourning period. Normally, I would think, when an adult child loses her first parent, there's a parent's spouse there to take over, to handle the technical decisions to bury and bequeath. My parents were divorced in the late 50s, and both were married to others for more than 20 years. My father's wife, Edie, died of cancer the year before he did. So we were his only heirs, and after my mother's death, her husband of 27 years and our stepfather, Gary Morton, learned from her executors that he had been lovingly and carefully provided for, but that she had placed Desi and me in charge of her estate. For any children, tending to an estate is an unwelcome and painful process, no matter when the loss comes. Being the one responsible for making all the important final decisions can be a great burden and an instant maturing process all at the same time. The organizing alone is overwhelming, from ridiculous details like who gets the gravy boat to selling the house, to where are you going to put all the stuff you simply aren't ready to part with, to choosing what kind of service you think your parent would want without ever having talked with her about it. Well, we did it not once, but twice within 3 years. And these were not ordinary parents. An old hatbox with a rusted zipper filled with graying white gloves without fingertips, which you'd assume was toss-it material, hardly worthy of the thrift shop pile, becomes a priceless museum piece when you realize that those gloves were worn by the professor character my mother immortalized on the I Love Lucy show. Every gown or pocketbook, every seemingly trivial possession that happened to be engraved became instant memorabilia. We had to think twice before putting it anywhere. My brother Desi and I debated the importance of preserving those things, and considering the frame of mind we were in at the time, the process often turned into hours of discussions about human destiny and the twisted priorities of would-be scavengers, often either reducing us both to tears of longing and numbness or giving way to hysterical fantasies of building life-size sculptures of Vitamita Vegemin with all the leftover henna rinse. After watching what happened to the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis estate, I wish we had sold it by the ounce and donated the proceeds to AIDS research. Oddly, in some ways, after all these years, life goes on as if they were still here, simply off somewhere, on location perhaps, and unable to get to a phone. If you go by the daily requests for their services, they'd both be happy to know, I'm sure, that they're almost busier now than when they were alive. On any given day, we field dozens of requests for film clips, memorial awards, memorabilia for charities, documentaries, television specials, movie deals, and countless licenses to merchandise rights, which we try to guide gracefully. Unfortunately, some of it translates into bizarre situations that neither Desi nor I enjoy dealing with very much. I really hate coming into my office in the morning and finding a full set of tiny bobbing head dolls on my desk that look like some Hitchcock interpretation of Lucy Ricardo with makeup by Salvador Dali. It's a lot to take in before you've had your coffee. Sometimes you want to just get on with your own life and not be forced to spend such enormous amounts of time talking about your deceased parents, to be continually liable for making responsible decisions on their behalf, to have to learn how to listen and decode all of the Scheistermeisters who spend endless amounts of otherwise useful energy weaving weirder and weirder ways to snag their own personal piece of the Lucy legend. And so many times, you wish they were still here. Even if, for a few moments, just so you could turn around and ask, "Is this okay? Do you mind if they do this?" But you quickly realize that the voices that once could both calm your fears and drive you so crazy are truly silent forever. Until one day, while trying to sort out some of the complicated legalities of running the estates, Desi and I asked our mother's former attorney, Ed Perlstein, to sift through some of his old file boxes in search of some contracts we needed, and something remarkable happened. There, in a dusty box of envelopes and tapes, he uncovered what turned out to be a never-before-published autobiographical work of our mother's. The package, postmarked 1966, from Betty Hannah Hoffman, Los Altos, California, simply said, "Lucy." The manuscript was written in the first person and seemed to span Mom's entire life up to 1964. I was stunned. When I read it, I cried. So many people, including myself, had tried to tell this story, but up until that moment, I never knew that my mother had written about her own life. When my brother Desi read the manuscript, he was overcome with emotion. He said, "I loved it. I loved it." There's wonderful energy that comes through, a fire in her belly. As a young kid, a sense of adventure, like, "I want to make some noise." Her connections from past to present, I salute her for her ability to think in terms of, what did I learn from the past? And there's some great, straight-from-the-heart advice. I love the way she wrote about her feelings for Dad. It was very powerful for me to hear about when she first met him. Some people prolong their unhappiness by dramatizing it, which, as Vernon Howard used to tell me, was like expecting applause for having a headache. Mom does not do this. Instead of over-dramatizing what happened in her life, she seems to be trying to understand what her life is all about. To learn to love in a new way. That's what I found most endearing about this autobiography, the way she looked at life. I have personally read hundreds of accounts of my mother's life over the years, and thought I knew it all. But there were so many more details in this, especially regarding her earlier memories and what happened during her most formative years that contributed to the kind of woman, actress, and mother she became. I only wished I had had access to all this priceless information in 1993 when I was making Lucy and Desi a home movie, as it would have saved me a lot of time in research and would have given me a much deeper understanding of the pain she had to assimilate as a child and the depth of her struggle to achieve the kind of success she eventually did. Now, along with a book, our father's fascinating, fact-filled reminiscence of his life, written in 1976, my brother and I, and our children, along with the whole Ball Arnaz clan, have one of the most remarkable, comprehensive family histories ever documented. Another wonderful discovery was that Mrs. Hoffman had taped all her interviews with Mom, so although this is an as-told-to autobiography, unlike some others I've read, I could hear my mother's voice in the phrasing. Later, when I had a chance to listen to the 20-some hours of original interviews, I realized that was because, for once in her life, my mother was quoted accurately. I, of course, was tempted every now and then, while editing, to insert the note, "See my father's book for his version of this same story." But even then, it was comforting to remember that there are always two sides to every story, and to take everyone's account of what happened to them with a grain of salsa. So what happened way back then that put this book in that box? I called Mom's longtime secretary, Wanda Clark, to see if she had any recollection of having worked on something like this, but Wanda was as shocked as I. The manuscript must have been tucked away shortly before she came to work for Mom. I called my Aunt Cleo, who had been producing my mother's radio shows around that same time, and who, at first, was as puzzled as Wanda had been, but who eventually said, "You know, I do have this memory of your mother talking into a tape recorder a lot." I called my stepfather Gary, my mother's brother Fred Ball, and longtime family friends like Marcella Rabwin, but no one knew anything about it. So I sent them all copies to help judge the manuscript's legitimacy and accuracy. Even though they had known her longer than almost anyone, each in his or her own way found her autobiography fascinating, intriguing, and illuminating, and marveled at her vivid recollections and the wealth of detail. And every one of them said something like, "Boy, you can really hear her voice in it." Finally, after many weeks of sleuthing, we were able to contact Mrs. Hoffman, now in her 70s and living in Northern California. And as we tried to piece together the hows, wheres, and whens, we discovered some of the whys. Apparently, in the early 1960s, not long after my mother had married Gary Morton, her dear friend and mentor, the late Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, encouraged her to record her thoughts about her dramatic and challenging life. But, knowing that she was starring in a television series and running a studio and trying to raise two high-voltage teenagers at the same time, and would probably be unable to complete the task herself, he suggested she work with someone and do an as-told-to type autobiography. I'm sure he must have convinced her that it would be historical and healing. Mrs. Hoffman worked with my mother for about 2 years, taping and transcribing interview sessions. In addition to these sessions, she traveled to Mom's hometown of Jamestown, New York, interviewed her childhood friends, and then gave shape and order to the information. Once given Mrs. Hoffman's name, people in my mother's circle began to recall the works having taken place and remembered it as a difficult process. And Cleo told me of one episode in particular. "I remember Betty used to come to me for help in figuring out ways to loosen your mother up and get her to tell the truth." I'm sure that one of my mother's motives for writing this was to set the record straight. Even by 1964, much had been written about her and my father that wasn't true. But I think, in the beginning, she was afraid that all Mrs. Hoffman would want to do was dwell on the D words, the drinking, the dames, and the divorce. And Mom was deeply concerned about hurting certain people who were still alive, especially my father, whom she still cared for very much. And Cleo remembered that whenever Betty tried to get a more in-depth response, Mom would say, "Hell, if I talked about all that, I'll lose my General Foods image." And Betty's smart retort, "Your General Foods image is Jell-O, and I'm not writing Jell-O." Betty was right. This ain't Jell-O. I was riveted. So why write something this good and then not let people read it? My stepfather Gary remembers my mother turning to him in bed one night to say that the book she was doing was upsetting her, that she just couldn't finish it right now because it might hurt Desi. Robert Osborne of The Hollywood Reporter worked with my mother in the Desi Lu workshop and recently told me that he did remember when she was working on the book. He recalls she was uncomfortable with writing an autobiography so soon because it made her feel as if the rest of her life wouldn't seem as important. Whatever her reasons, all parties remember that the project was shelved with the understanding that everybody just forget about it, which is apparently what most people did. Even in early April 1989, when my husband Lawrence Luckinbill and I and our three children spent that Easter vacation with Mom and Gary in Palm Springs, she was telling us how she had finally agreed to begin work on an as-told-to autobiography for Putnam with her friend and respected journalist Bob Thomas. Either she had forgotten about the 300-page head start she had lying around somewhere, or she figured it would be easier to just start from scratch with someone entirely new. We'll never know. But I do remember how much she was dreading the April 1st deadline to start working with Bob. She seemed completely overwhelmed by the task, couldn't imagine how or where to even begin. She no longer needed to fear hurting my father since he had passed away 2.5 years before. Yet she feared everything else, that her memory wasn't sharp enough anymore, that nobody would want to hear any of this stuff. All the reminiscing was reminding her that a lot of friends and loved ones upon whom she would have liked to call for help, were no longer around. Unfortunately, no one else had a chance to help her remember either. She died less than 3 weeks later. I remember thinking then how sadly ironic it was that my father should have gotten the chance to tell his story during his lifetime, but that we'd never get to hear Mom's, to see her life as she saw it. Sad for the family. Sad for the world. But since my mother and my father always insisted on a happy ending, I should have known. My brother Desi and I decided to share this with you now because we believe that's what she would have wanted, and inscribed it to all of you the way she would have signed it. Simply, Love Lucy. So, after all the rubber reproductions, the reruns, and the rag sheet writings, after all those anemic imitations, and with her impeccable timing, she's come back to speak for herself in her own voice. Or in this case, mine. Lucy Arnaz. 1. I'm a Leo. I was born on a Sunday, August 6th, 1911. Unfortunately, everybody knows my birthday because I told the truth when I first came to Hollywood. I grew up not on the sidewalks of New York City, as some people think, but in the beautiful resort area of Lake Chautauqua, New York, near the green, wooded Allegheny Wilderness. I used to say I was born in Butte, Montana. I thought it sounded more glamorous than Western New York. I was conceived in Montana when my father was working for his father as a lineman at the Independent Telephone Company in Anaconda. But I was born in my grandparents' apartment on Stewart Street in Jamestown, New York, where I was delivered by my grandmother, Flora Bell Hunt. My mother, Desiree Hunt, or Dee Dee, as we call her, was of French-English descent with a touch of Irish from her father's side that showed in her porcelain-fine English complexion and auburn hair. Dee Dee was so talented musically that she could have been a fine concert pianist. But at 17, she met and married a local Jamestown boy, my father, Henry Durrell Ball. As soon after my birth as my mother could travel, she insisted we return to Montana and Henry. Henry was tall, with intense, penetrating blue eyes. He was a wonderful guy, according to everyone who knew him. Full of fun, with a good comic sense. Dee Dee says I got my sense of humor from him. People are always asking me if Ball is my real name. As a young model, I tried being Diane Belmont for a while, but that kind of phony elegance wasn't for me. All I know about the Ball side of my family is that they are descended from an English family which owned houses and lands in Herefordshire in some early period. There were Ball mariners, hunters, priests, and barons, but it appears no actors. As for the American branch of the family, there was some Ball blood in George Washington. His mother's maiden name was Mary Ball. Ball family records place them in New York, Pennsylvania, Vermont, Massachusetts, and I found gravestones of several Balls on Arthur Godfrey's farm in Virginia when we visited him last spring. For almost 4 years, I was an only child. My young parents showered me with affection. I was at the center of the stage. Life was a lark. Dee Dee tried dressing me in ribbons and bows, but I rebelled, never being the prissy doll type. My father roughhoused with me as he might with a boy, tossing me to the ceiling and catching me a few feet from the floor and giving me piggybacks. I screamed with delight while Dee Dee worried about the tomboy she was raising. I'm known among comedians as a stunt girl who will do anything. Red Skelton flatters me by saying I have the courage of a tiger. I don't think it's a matter of bravery. It's just doing what comes naturally. I do know that if an actress has the slightest aversion to pie in the face or pratfalls, the camera will pick it up instantly. The audience won't laugh. They'll suffer in sympathy. Perhaps my willingness to be knocked off a 20-foot pedestal or shot down a steamship funnel goes back to my earliest, happiest days with my father. I knew he was going to catch me. I wasn't going to get hurt. Dee Dee says that I adored my young father. When I was about 3... she got tired of the 40-below Montana winters and homesick for the gentle green hills of home, so eastward we went to Wyandotte, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, where my father became foreman of a telephone line crew. Late one day, the following January, my father caught the grip and went to bed. Several days later, a whopper of a sleet storm hit Detroit. Being a highly conscientious guy, my father bundled up to get the crews and the payroll out. Despite his bad cough and fever, he climbed up poles in the sleet and snow, trying to secure the tangled fallen wires. He kept going until the emergency was over, only to return to bed, this time with his fever raging. My young mother was 5 months pregnant when my father fell ill. To keep me under control, she tied me to a dog leash, which she then hitched to the clothesline in our backyard. Every time somebody would pass by on the sidewalk, I'd beg to be released. I must have been pretty convincing because I was set free a lot. Then poor Dee Dee would have to frantically search the neighborhood for me. My mother finally made arrangements with our kindly corner grocery store owner, Mr. Flower. He let me prance up and down his counter reciting little pieces my parents had taught me. My favorite was apparently a frog routine where I hopped up and down harumphing. Then I'd gleefully accept the pennies or candy Mr. Flower's customers would give me. My first professional appearance. My father's condition never improved. His grip turned into typhoid fever. He died not long after that storm. He was only 28, and my mother was almost 23. I was not yet 4. But I remember vividly the moment she told me Daddy was gone. I could tell you where the tables were, where the windows were, what they looked out on, where the bed was. And I remember at that very moment, a picture suddenly fell from the wall, and I noticed on the kitchen windowsill some little gray sparrows feeding. I've been superstitious about birds ever since. I've heard that birds flying in the window are supposed to bring bad luck. I don't have a thing about live birds, but pictures of birds get me. I won't buy anything with a print of a bird, and I won't stay in a hotel room with bird pictures or bird wallpaper. From Wyandotte, on a cold March morning, we returned to Jamestown with my father's coffin. And Dee Dee says I showed very little emotion until the funeral service. As they lowered his coffin into the ground and began filling in his grave, she says, I let out a blood-curdling scream she'll never forget and wouldn't stop until she carried me away. After that, my mother and I returned to her parents' home in Jamestown. The next few years were very difficult ones for Dee Dee. She had practically no money, and her parents had little to spare. I think she was a little stunned by her unhappy circumstances. I can remember her shaking her head, saying softly, "Married before I was 18, a mother before I was 19, and widowed before I was 23." The future must have looked very bleak to her. She had been deeply in love with my father. I know she missed him very much. Dee Dee's parents, my grandfather and grandmother Hunt, were then living in a small place on Buffalo Street in Jamestown. Their only son, my uncle Harold, had died of tuberculosis just a few years before when he was only 18. They hadn't yet recovered from that loss, so when Dee Dee gave birth to a fine baby boy 4 months after my father's death, they were overjoyed. My brother arrived on Saturday, July 17th, 1915, and was christened Fred Henry after Grandpa Hunt, who passed out cigars at the furniture factory that day and boasted to everybody about his fine boy, Freddy. He really thought of Freddy as his own. I was largely ignored, and I became very jealous. It's always hard to go from being an only child to having an infant sibling in the house. Since my father had just died, I'm sure I was particularly sensitive to the great fuss that was made over the new baby. Dee Dee must have remembered that because in 1953, when friends poured into our house with presents for little Desi, she stood by the front door and reminded them to be sure and say hello to little Lucy first. I remember feeling jealous about Freddy, but it, of course, wasn't his fault. He was a calm and level-headed little boy, cooperative and hard-working. He took good care of all his belongings, never broke anything of mine. He never strayed far from home, either, or caused anybody concern or worry. I was the tomboy and the daredevil, not Freddy. By the time I was 12 and Freddy was 8, I adored him and have never changed my mind. After Freddy's birth, my mother became more and more depressed. So finally, it was decided that she should go to California for a complete change of scene. Freddie stayed with my mother's parents, while I was sent to live with my Aunt Lola, my mother's younger sister. Lola was a plump, bosomy, easygoing woman who ran the best beauty shop in town. She had just married a Greek named George Mandikos. George had been born and raised in Greece and spoke with an intriguing accent. He was the first Mediterranean type in my life, and he fascinated me. With my father dead and me now separated from my mother, I naturally fell madly in love with Uncle George. My aunt and uncle were still honeymooning during this time. Distracted by each other, they couldn't have cared less whether I got to school or not. So most days, I spent in my aunt's beauty shop or following Uncle George. Once again, I was an only child with a mother and a father, and it was such a happy, relaxed time for me. Dee Dee, however, was miserable away from her children, so in a year or so, back she came to Jamestown. She'd been a widow for about 3 years when she married a big, ugly, handsome Swede named Ed Peterson. He was a metal polisher who enjoyed his home-brewed beer on Saturday night and took pride in his handsome wardrobe. Ed was known as a dresser, and when he turned himself out, he looked like the King of Sweden. Ed was a pleasant guy to have around, but despite his marriage to our mother, he never thought of himself as a father to me or Freddie. On Dee Dee's wedding day, I remember I sidled up to the new groom, so thrilled to have a father again. "Are you our new daddy?" I smiled up at him. Ed looked down at me with surprise. "Call me Ed," he said shortly, shaking his hand free of my vice-like grip. And that's the way it was. Ed was never mean or abusive, but his presence in the house was shadowy. We barely had time to get acquainted with him before he and Dee Dee went off to Detroit to look for jobs, leaving me and Freddie behind. My brothers stayed with our doting grandparents, while I was parceled out to Ed's parents, the Petersons. Nothing had ever prepared me for such hard, sour, cheerless people. And since the Petersons were both quite elderly, I'm sure they were about as pleased as I was by our new living arrangements. Having accepted the responsibility, Grandma Peterson was not one to shirk her duty. She had been born in Sweden, and her attitude toward the free and easy ways of America was one of distrust and suspicion. A devout Christian, she strove to keep her life and mine free of indulgences. Anything that gave pleasure lapsed into one of the seven deadly sins and was therefore devil's bait. Nothing in this life was ever to be enjoyed, only endured. Grandma Peterson took me to Sunday school regularly, and I remember a lot of talk of fire and brimstone there. Punishments were frequent and, to me, unreasonable, since I never got a satisfactory explanation of my crimes. My grandmother complained to the Hunts that I was difficult and headstrong. She told me that I was a nervous child and sassy, bold, silly. And why not? I had so little outlet for my physical energies. My usual punishment was solitary confinement in my room, or being sent to bed before the sun went down in summertime when I could hear the happy shouts of other children playing outdoors. Grandma Peterson saw to it that Satan found no mischief for my idle hands. She bought linen toweling by the yard and had me roll the edges by hand, finicky work that made me want to jump out of my skin. Another chore was darning the Peterson hose, which were as thick as a horse blanket. I was taught to knit and crochet. That last skill took. I still crochet with great enjoyment. Everything from baby booties to coverlets for beds. Washing dishes was a daily chore, and, ugh, how I hated it. The kitchen was small and dark, and the sink was so high I had to stand on a box to reach it. The only light came from one weak gas jet. The water was heated on top of the stove and soon became lukewarm and greasy. After Grandmother Peterson inspected the finished job, she often made me start all over. In retrospect, learning those domestic skills certainly didn't hurt me, and later on, my own mother kept me at chores until I did them right, but where the Petersons made housework a grim chore, at the Hunts, we kids got a sense of cozy togetherness from pitching in. There were some small advantages to the harsh, isolated life I led with the Petersons. I used to welcome a rainy day. Then I was allowed to play with my clothespin dolls in a corner of the back porch. I can close my eyes and still see the leaden sky, the rain splashing off the porch roof, the bright green maple leaves clinging together like wet crepe paper. And I can hear my involved conversations with those dolls. Curiously enough, Grandmother Peterson had a green thumb, and I have her to thank for my great love for flowers, especially spring flowers. Somewhere inside of her, there must have been a well of maternal tenderness which found expression in the way she pruned and prayed over and tended her roses, her prized dahlias, the bulbs she brought indoors during the winter and set out again in the spring. I don't suppose that hard work discipline and a perfectionist attitude toward my work did me any harm. They are a big part of my makeup today, as any of my co-workers will tell you. And when life seemed unbearable, I learned to live in my imagination and to step inside other people's skins. Indispensable abilities for an actress. On the other hand, I have my Grandmother Peterson to thank for the gnawing sense of unworthiness and insecurity that haunted me for years. The Puritan idea that everything pleasurable is somehow bad almost ruined for me the first joys of our big I Love Lucy success. The hardest thing for me was getting used to the idea that I deserved it. I went back to visit the Petersons on many later occasions, and I finally realized that in her strange way, Ed's mother was actually fond of me, despite her strict old country ways. When Dee Dee and Ed returned from Detroit, Grandfather Hunt decided to buy a place in the country so we could all live together under the same roof. On February 1st, 1920, Fred P. Hall and Lucy M. Hall deeded to Fred C. Hunt and Flora B. Hunt for the sum of $2,000 our new home on 8th Street in Celeron. Boy, were we excited. I was so grateful to have a mother again. I never went through a critical, oh, mother, stage with Dee Dee. I always knew that she was on my side. It never occurred to me to talk back or argue. Over the years, I have always treasured her advice, which is salty, sensible, and never one-sided. Having her back again was just about the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Dee Dee still feels guilty about the time we were apart, but I understand that circumstances forced our separation. And she certainly has made up for it with unflagging devotion ever since. When we speak of the slights of our childhood, it's hard to remember that often people were struggling to do their level best. This knowledge comes to you later in life, of course, when you have children of your own. Once we were all back together again with Grandma and Grandpa Hunt, everything straightened out magically. Dee Dee still had to work full-time, but my grandparents were home quite a lot. I have them to thank for most of the happy times of my childhood. My grandfather Hunt began life as the only son of a well-to-do Jamestown hotel owner. Grandpa Hunt worked in his father's hotel, then ran a grocery store in Jamestown, and was also a postman, a maker of optical instruments, and a chiropractor. Some people called him doctor from his brief brush with that last calling. He kept his old chiropractor's leather couch, and neighbors soon learned how his strong fingers could ease an aching back. He was also a skilled wood turner. When I was quite young, this is how he earned his living in one of Jamestown's fine furniture plants. Grandfather Fred had a jaunty air about him, with bright blue eyes and sandy hair that kept its color even into his 70s. He was at once cunning, cute, cocky, and wonderfully good to us kids. He met and married my grandmother, Flora Bell Orchid, when she was a chambermaid in his father's hotel. The Orchids had farmed for several generations in the rolling green countryside around Charlotte Center, a crossroads about 20 miles from Jamestown. They were strong, sturdy folk with the earthy good sense that comes from tending animals and tilling the soil. I can still remember some of those wonderful meals we had around the Orchids' groaning board. Flora Bell was one of five sets of twins and was orphaned at an early age. At one time, the children were about to be sent to an orphanage, and Flora Bell, although she was not the oldest, lost no time in getting all her nine brothers and sisters under the same roof. They've all held her in great respect. Grandmother Floribel was very beautiful, with good bone structure, curly salt and pepper hair, a trim figure, and good legs. Her hands were also very shapely with long fingers, but red and roughened from hard work and the strong solutions she used as a practical nurse. She was just about the best midwife in Jamestown and was much in demand. Floribel was a dedicated nurse with a very open, welcoming attitude toward the world. Always cooking, cleaning, sewing, she was a sunny, active, vigorous woman, a dreamer, and a planner. Nothing was too much for her. No hours too long, no time better spent than doing things for her family. Grandmother Hunt didn't have much formal education, and she hung on Grandfather's every word. He was the bookish type, interested in words and their derivations, and fond of reading aloud. Sometimes it was poetry, and sometimes politics, or a book like Black Beauty, which he read to us kids. Grandmother would come into the room and sit quietly, sewing as she listened. I remember the scratchy sound her work-roughened fingers made as she handled scraps of silk for her quilts. Sometimes, if the story he read was a sad one, tears would slip down her soft cheeks, falling on the silk in her lap. My grandparents had little money, but they gave us a richly satisfying family life. I was 8 and a half years old when we all moved into the little three-bedroom house on 8th Street in Celeron, which held first two and then three families. I loved every inch of that weathered shingled house. It had a front porch and a back shed and a small, dark front parlor separated from the front hall by portières. These were the stage curtains for our innumerable productions as Freddie and I grew up. My bedroom was in the rear, overlooking the big backyard with its high hedge of purple lilacs. My bureau had three drawers. The bottom drawer was filled with stage costumes. Old bedspreads, discarded curtains, bits of chicken feathers, ribbon, and lace all found their way into that drawer and were happily put to use. No sooner were both families cozily under one roof than Aunt Lola gave birth to a daughter with the expert help of Grandmother Floribel. Since Aunt Lola had a beauty shop to run, her daughter Cleo stayed with us and became our baby. Cleo had great dark eyes, black curly hair, plump dimpled little knees, and her mother's good humor. As soon as she could walk, she was added to our repertory company. I would dress her, make her up, and rehearse her lines with her. Since all the adult members of the household worked, I seldom went anywhere without Freddie hanging on to one hand and Cleo the other. For as jealous as I was of Freddie at his birth, it wasn't long before I'd completely taken him under my wing. Not only was he a level-headed and hard-working little boy, he was an amiable co-star in all of our homespun productions. Many of the inspirations for our stage plays came from the fine productions we saw on summer evenings at Celeron Amusement Park, which was just a hop, skip, and a jump from our house across a daisy field and a railroad track. The park was built by the owners of Jamestown's worsted mills and street railways at the turn of the century. To us, it was as unique and wonderful as Disneyland is today, with its calliope, Ferris wheel, and merry-go-round. Many wealthy Pittsburgh oil families built summer homes on Lake Chautauqua, and Dee Dee could remember when they came to the park dressed to the teeth, riding shiny carriages with matched chestnuts and liveried grooms. Back then, there was a lake steamer which brought in boatloads from the world-famous Chautauqua Institute at the northern end of the lake. Sousa performed in the bandshell, and Pauline McLean performed Mrs. Wiggs of the Cabbage Patch in the summer. She stayed in a rented house in Celeron. I used to hang around outside hoping to catch a glimpse of my idol. One morning, she threw open the window and stood there, shaking out her sheets and blankets, in curlers and a dust cap. That was a disillusioning sight. There was no admission fee to the park, and any summer evening we could stroll over and watch the fountains of colored water or the spectacular fireworks or see the perils of Pauline on the flickering outdoor screen. A man named Rex, who sported black tights, made balloon ascensions in a little basket. After hovering for a while, he'd parachute into the park and sometimes, if the wind was strong, into the lake. When its load of gas was spent, the balloon would come down and there was a reward for anyone who found it. I can still picture it streaking down from the sky like a long, black cigar. Céloron got its name from a French explorer, a Comte de Céloron. In the late 18th century, he paddled down the 20-mile Lake Chautauqua and landed at the southern end of the lake, which thereafter was known as Céloron. Next, the British claimed the land, and then the Americans. Most of the early settlers in the area came from New England. This Puritan heritage is deep in my blood. My dearest dream is to live in a little white house in New England with a lilac bush by the front door. My husband Gary calls me one of the Eskimo people. He dotes on sunshine and hot weather and hates the snow and ice. We really had blizzards in Céloron. The lake froze solid a mile across and was covered with ice skaters and ice boats and ice fishermen. I'd love to live in New England, where I could have that bright, clean air and clean snow and change of seasons. There's another New England thing about me, and that's a strong, conservative, Puritan streak. I've always known right from wrong, and I'd like to know how I learned this to make sure my kids do. I'm the most conservative member of my family. Grandfather Freddie was a progressive and a free thinker. Dee Dee was a product of the Roaring Twenties. She believed in letting go and expressing yourself. Bang your fists and let your feelings out. She never gave a fig what other people said or thought. My mother gave us kids freedom and was permissive. Dee Dee says she knew what stuff we were made of and trusted us. I do know that growing up right next to an amusement park can be very bad. Some of the kids ran wild there. And although I appreciated the magic of the place and the spell of make-believe it cast, it's hard to develop a real sense of values growing up next to a commercial carnival. But apparently, I profited from the experience. I am not easily taken in by anyone. The little red-brick Céloron schoolhouse, which we attended from kindergarten through high school, was just half a block from our house. I was lucky to grow up in a regular little United Nations. Kids of old Anglo-Saxon stock and kids whose fathers and grandfathers came from Italy, Albania, Greece, Germany, Poland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. Jamestown is a great furniture center, and skilled woodworkers came there from all over the world. So many of my classmates had fathers who were highly skilled craftsmen. Like my grandfather, they took great pride in their work. Grandfather had a little workshop at home where he made us all kinds of things. He built us sleds and wagons and wheelbarrows, stilts, pogo sticks, swings, teeter-totters, and tree houses. And just for me, he made the most absolutely marvelous doll furniture, some of which I still treasure. Using fine pieces of cherry and walnut and mahogany, he turned and scrolled the tiny posts of doll beds and chair legs. Gradually, mass production methods displaced the old slow, careful, finicky ways of making fine furniture. My grandfather learned to run a lathe, but he missed the satisfaction of transforming a piece of wood into something of elegance and beauty with his own hands. He wound up as a factory worker before the days of the unions and saw many abuses of authority. And because he was an idealist, a sincere humanitarian, he became a follower of socialist leader Eugene Debs, a fiery defender of all underdogs. I remember the glorious day in Céloron when the indoor bathtub arrived. We already had an indoor bathroom with a toilet, to put it indelicately, but no tub since we had no hot water. Saturday night baths meant heating the water on the big iron wood-burning kitchen stove. When we were small, I got the first turn in the galvanized wash tub, followed by Freddie. In the summertime, Grandfather wouldn't let us go swimming in Lake Chautauqua without taking along a cake of soap for shampooing our hair and washing all over. So we really felt like celebrating when hot water and a tub finally arrived. It was a new luxury to soak and scrub in privacy. We kids always called Grandfather Hunt Daddy and kept calling him that to the end of his days. He was our daddy in the sense that he was the man of the household whom we loved and obeyed. He was great on discipline, and if you didn't hop to it at once, wham, you got it. Once I dilly-dallied too long getting to the dinner table, and Daddy spanked me with the gravy spoon, with gravy still on it. There was hot chicken gravy all over the dining room, and my Sunday dress, too. The great thing about my grandfather Hunt was that he took such good care of everything. He taught us the same pride of ownership. Once I slid down the coal bin in the cellar, tearing my dress and ruining my white shoes with coal dust. I really got it good. That cellar was a fascinating place to me. Mysterious and at the same time so planned and orderly. There were the empty boxes left over from one Christmas waiting for the next, the fragrance of freshly cut wood, rows of grandmother's canning, the damp smell of the earth floor. Eggs were kept in a pottery crock. It was kind of spooky reaching down into the cold brine, getting wet to the elbow. And those damn spiders. Oof! How I hated them. Snakes would crawl in there, too. Look, Daddy would say, picking one up. It's just a garter snake. Don't you see? He's harmless. Of course, there were rattlesnakes and copperheads in the area, and he taught us to recognize them, too. As he taught us to know the poisonous kinds of mushrooms. Daddy's truck garden drew admirers from miles around. He kept us in fresh vegetables and berries all summer, and the rest was canned for good eating all during the long, hard winters. During the cold weather, the cat always gave birth to a litter of kittens in the cellar and hid them down there. Then, some evening, when we were all upstairs, she would cry at the cellar door. When one of us would let her out, she'd carry her brood up, one by one, by the scruff of the neck, so we could admire them. While Cleo was still a baby, Grandmother Floribel gave up a lot of her nursing jobs and stayed home to look after her. But then Grandmother's health began to fail, and looking after the younger kids and getting supper on the table became my responsibility. I couldn't understand why Grandmother's nerves would sometimes snap, but her pain and our racket must have been unbearable at times. Dee Dee said that I had to practice the piano for 1 hour every afternoon after school. She was a wonderful pianist and insisted that I had music in me, and that's where it stayed, in me. Grandmother used to encourage me to practice, too, but once she fell ill, my playing only seemed to irritate her. I just couldn't understand the change in my beloved grandmother. Then one day I learned that she had uterine cancer and wasn't going to get well. She got weaker and weaker. Toward the end, she lay all the time in her big mahogany bed in the front parlor. Grandmother Hunt wasted away. When she died, released at last from her suffering, I was not allowed to go to the funeral. I took little Cleo and Freddie by the hand and followed the funeral procession down the street, crying my heart out. Grandmother Hunt was only 51 when she died. Because of her, I have a special place in my heart for cancer research. Although she knew her own case was hopeless, she prayed to the end for a cure for others. Each Memorial Day, we would cut great branches of blooming lilacs from the purple bushes in the backyard and carry them to Lakeview Cemetery to Grandmother's grave. Since those days, lilac has become almost an obsession with me. Someone once interpreted my passion for it as signaling a return to the womb, to Celeron, to the innocent happiness of childhood. Whatever the reason, the emotional tug is so overwhelming that I've been known to plan trips to New England in May just to see and smell lilac in bloom. It's difficult to grow in California, although I've been trying for many years. There are actually male and female bushes, although nobody seems to be able to tell them apart. We just plant them all together in the sunniest corner of the garden and hope. This year, they bloomed for the very first time. They don't have the fragrance of lilacs in the East, of course. Still, I was delighted. After Grandmother Hunt died, there was no adult in the house during the day. I suddenly found myself in her shoes at the age of 11. Freddie was then 7 and Cleo 3. Dee Dee was certainly a powerful example of a woman's dedication to her family. She could seldom get home from her job selling hats until 6 or 6:30, including Saturdays. So it was my job to make the beds, do the dusting, make sure the table was set, cook dinner, and do the supper dishes. Then Dee Dee would be up past midnight scrubbing and ironing clothes, mending and sewing. She had 2 dresses to her name, both black, which she kept brushed and clean and wore with white collars or pearls. At this time, Dee Dee was 30, still a handsome woman with an infectious laugh. Selling hats was tedious work. My mother was on her feet long hours, and the pay was low. She never complained and always put on a good front. But we knew how the fatigue and worry of making ends meet aggravated her excruciating migraine headaches. I'm a headache sufferer myself, so I know what she went through. But luckily for me, today headaches can be better controlled. I can still see Dee Dee now, on Sunday afternoons, parceling her weekly earnings into little envelopes. There would be $1.25 for insurance, or $4 for a new clothes washer, or $2 for a new set of porch furniture, everything bought on time. But I had the most beautiful clothes of any kid in school. I was always the first with the latest, be it a raccoon coat, open galoshes, or the blue serge midi blouse to go with my short boyish bob. Dee Dee always wanted the best for her children, even if it meant going into hock to pay for it. Every afternoon, we'd telephone her at Marcus's, the elegant dress shop where she worked in Jamestown. As soon as she heard we were all safely home from school, she'd hang up. Then we'd play-act the rest of the afternoon until we saw Dee Dee step off the trolley at the end of the street. Then Freddie would rush to set the table, and I'd throw together the beds. Then I'd get out the dust mop. When Dee Dee walked in, she'd first look up the stairwell to see how many clouds of dust were still dancing in the light. I don't remember her ever being upset about it, but she'd have some remark that let us know we hadn't fooled anyone. I missed not having her around all the time, that day-to-day closeness I try to give my own children, but even then I understood why this was just not possible. About that time, when I was 11 or 12, I tried my first cigarette. Dee Dee came into my little back bedroom and found it blue with smoke. "Oh, so you're smoking now," she remarked pleasantly. "Let's have one together." She kept me inhaling one cigarette after another until I turned purple, then green. I was 18 before I tried smoking again. Aunt Lola often let me help out in her beauty shop. I'd operate on the customer's children, frizzing their hair with a smoking-hot Marcel iron and nicking their ears with the shingling shears. I think I actually put Aunt Lola out of business. The children's irate mothers just refused to come near the place. Ultimately, Aunt Lola closed up shop and went into nursing. However, I still love everything about the beauty business. I have a room full of hairdressing equipment and give permanents, hair sets, manicures, and pedicures to this day. Only now I'm good at it. When she left to enter nurse's training, Aunt Lola also got a divorce from my Uncle George. He moved away and out of our lives. And Cleo stayed with us. She was a cuddly, affectionate child who often crawled into Dee Dee's bed or lap to be comforted. Our pet name for her was Cleo Baby. Freddie was Fritzy Boy. And I was, "Lucille, what the hell are you doing now?" Among the things that made life interesting in Celeron were the train wrecks. The Erie tracks ran around the lake from Mayville, the county seat to the north, and passed just a few hundred yards from our house. One day, Mrs. Curtis, the only wealthy member of our community, got stuck on the tracks in her electric car. She lived in a big stucco house which took up a whole block, surrounded by a big high fence. She was a mysterious person to us kids, since we knew so little about her. Apparently, she was slightly deaf, for she never heard the train coming before the collision. The car was demolished, but Mrs. Curtis merely injured. The train conductors loaded her into the baggage car and chugged off to Jamestown in the hospital. At the scene of the wreck, I found some amber beads. I toyed with the idea of keeping them, but in the end, honesty prevailed. After Mrs. Curtis got home from the hospital, I marched through her impressive front gate and rang the doorbell. She turned out to be a sweet and charming lady. She gave me the most thrilling gift I had ever received, a reward for returning the beads, a real gold wristwatch. Another time, an Erie freight car came uncoupled and rode up over the flat car in front. There was a tremendous crash and sound of splintering wood as 25 freight cars toppled off the track. People came pouring out of their homes, and so did I, but not empty-handed. I bounded across the field with a bucket of water in each hand. No homeless tramp was going to burn up in one of those freight cars if I could help it. Being the eldest, I had to keep track of the two younger kids. Luckily, they were both easy to manage and seldom got into mischief. Dee Dee really loaded me with heavy responsibilities, but more important, she trusted me to make the right decisions. My childhood was challenging, but not backbreaking. Dee Dee set the challenges, and I pretty much met them and grew stronger. People with happy childhoods never overdo. They don't strive or exert themselves. They're moderate, pleasant, well-liked, and good citizens. Society needs them. But the tremendous drive and dedication necessary to succeed in any field, not only show business, often seems to be rooted in a disturbed childhood. I wasn't an unloved or an unwanted child, but I was moved around a lot, and then death and cruel circumstances brought many painful separations. My adolescence was about as stormy as you might imagine. I had a red-headed temper, though no red hair, in those days. Cleo remembers me as a creative, strong-willed teenager, whirling like a pinwheel. I can remember kicking, rolling, biting fights on the school grounds. There were some girls I certainly had some rounds with, and a few boys, too. There was an Italian typing teacher I was crazy about, but once she made me so mad I threw a typewriter at her. It takes me a long time to get angry, but when I do, it's such a compilation of things over a long period that nobody can quite understand what triggered it finally, even myself. There's a great deal of difference between temperament and temper. Temperament is something you welcome creatively, for it's based on sensitivity, empathy, awareness. But a bad temper takes too much out of you and doesn't really accomplish anything. 2. When I got to be 13, a lot of pressures that had been building up for years suddenly found expression. Most of my stunts were the kind of silly antics most teenagers do to draw attention to themselves. On a dare, I roller skated on the freshly varnished school gymnasium floor, tore through Celeron sitting on the front radiator of a boy's tin Lizzy. And I ran away a lot. I'd leave the classroom for a drink of water and never come back. Looking back, I think my main need was for somebody to talk to confide in, some wise and sympathetic older person. My school principal, Bernard Drake, became such a person. Mr. Drake was the first person to label my exuberant feelings as talent and to urge me to go on the stage. In the 8th grade, I had many long, satisfying talks with him. Then he left Celeron to work at a state normal school. I missed him so much that one day I took little Cleo by the hand and we hitchhiked 50 miles to his new home. He called Dee Dee and had us on a bus the next morning. The summer that I was 14, an immense restlessness swept over me. Things weren't going too well at home. Dee Dee and Ed got divorced 5 or 6 years later, but the first real fights and arguments started about this time. My mother's face grew pinched with worry, and often a taxi would bring her home from the store in the middle of the afternoon, suffering one of her migraine headaches. She would lie in a darkened room with the shades drawn, unable to move or talk until the attack passed. I worried about her and the hard life she led. Grandpa Hunt wasn't too happy either, running his lathe at Crescent Tool. Ever since Grandmother Floribel died, he seemed torn loose from his moorings. It made him mad that the factory workers shared little of the great prosperity then sweeping the country. This, of course, was long before the days of Social Security or unemployment benefits. When a man lost his job, his family could starve, and a serious illness could bankrupt him for life. All of the local kids got summer jobs at the amusement park. I was hired as a short-order cook at a hamburger stand. I took my job very seriously and loved earning the money. "Look out! Look out! Don't step there!" I'd suddenly holler at some person passing by, and as he stopped, startled, one foot in midair and looking worriedly at the ground, I'd continue, "Step over here and get yourself a delicious hamburger." This mesmerized a lot of people into buying, and incidentally, they were darn good hamburgers. Dee Dee kept a strict check on me, and I had to be home at a certain time each night. I wasn't allowed to go out in any canoes. The one time I decided to live dangerously and went canoeing with a boy, I had to tip it over to get back. I got wet, but was still virtuous. Dee Dee had to force me to go to my first dance at the Celeron Pier Ballroom. They still had all the big-name bands like Harry James and Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman. Dee Dee let me wear lipstick, and she made me a perfectly beautiful dress of pussy willow taffeta with a band of real fur around the bottom. A girl at the dance, wearing some stale dress, oohed and awed over it, and then asked,
Can I have it?
The next day, I gave it to her. Dee Dee was furious. I don't blame her. But this girl came from a very large, poor family and never had any nice things. But the most momentous thing that happened to me during my 14th summer was that I fell in love.